Hi everyone, and welcome to the Rexilon podcast. I'm Kirby Lachrunji.
And I'm Dawn Riddler. Every week we bring you the highlights, lowlights, and musings around the global econo-political environment that we feel might impact on your wealth.
Week 14, and we're back in a week where there's going to be a full week of work again. So this week on the podcast, Trump media, US jobs, looking at where those are, US home sales, global inflation, and Magnificent Seven. Also, towards the end of the podcast, we're going to be looking at Daniel Kahneman. If you don't know who Daniel Kahneman was, please stay tuned so that you could listen into how he has fundamentally changed the world of finance. Just quickly, the markets, the S&P 500 for the week down 9.95%, the Dow Jones down 2.27%, the NASDAQ was down 0.80%, across in Europe, Euro Stoxx 50 down minus 1.38%. And then if one looks at the Nikkei 225, that was down 3.37%. And then across in China, most of those markets ended up for the week. Looking at currencies, the rand against the dollar, 1867. We've certainly seen some strength in the rand, or just the dollar's strength taking a pause. Euro against the ZAR, 2026. Against the Great British Pound, 2363. And if you're following crypto, Bitcoin against US dollars, $67,755 per Bitcoin. Dawn, again, it's an interesting week. I saw markets taking a bit of a breather, and then we're starting to see a bit of a late rally again into markets. I think markets are just in consolidation phase. I'm actually, and if I write about the quarter that was the kind of the first quarter of 2024, and I look forward, I kind of say to most investors, just take a bit of a backseat. The markets are just going to cool a bit before they start ramping into the next phase. What are they looking for? Well, they're looking for where rates are going to go. I think that's the first thing. And then secondly, they're looking for strength in the US economy and probably some more liquidity joining the system. And we'll have to see how that kind of plays itself out. I think for most part now, Dawn, interest rates in the United States probably will start dropping only towards the latter part of the year. We're not going to see that happening at the moment. That certainly is what the data shows. And then, quite frankly, South Africa is not going to drop rates if the US doesn't drop rates.
Yes, absolutely. And I picked up, and I don't know whether you picked up last week, Governor of the Reserve Bank actually came out and said, not in a huge hurry to drop those interest rates. And obviously, one of the major concerns, not just protecting, stopping inflation getting out of control, but protecting the rand. That's one of their major considerations there. But interestingly, the governor of the Reserve Bank also indicated that he might be dropping the target that they use for inflation, which is currently between 3% and 6% downwards. And downwards, he probably means between 2% and 4%, or maybe 2% and 5%, which is more in line with what the US and the EU do, which is interesting. And I think that we've also shown over the last 3 years that that's actually obtainable.
I mean, it'll be interesting to see because, I mean, the rand continues to depreciate against the dollar. We continue to see that, what is the average number? 5% per annum. That's kind of the depreciation number. We continue to see that happening, which means that imported goods just continue to get more and more expensive, driving inflation higher. And it's not only that, but it's also all the basic foodstuffs, because all of that is linked to international prices and so on. It'll be interesting to see how they create stability in the currency or attempt to do that, which really is a function at the end of the day of stability in the fiscus. And that's, we don't have at this stage. If they can get that right, then 2% to 4% becomes a lot easier to target than what we have at the moment. But perhaps that happens. You know, we're going to have to see how the politics play itself out. We're going to have to see how the elections play itself out. Dawn, elections are next month. You know, towards the end of next month is elections. It's around the corner. And that could be quite an interesting moment for South Africa. So there's obviously, you see the political parties are all out trying to get their manifestos, you know, communicated and what they're going to be doing. Much more of just the same old that we've seen before. But perhaps maybe South Africans become a lot more vocal at the voting station. You know, there's a lot more at stake today than I think there was, you know, a decade ago, where I think maybe lots, you know, it was easy just to be laissez-faire about this thing and saying, listen, I'm not going to vote. Perhaps we see more people just going to the voting station and saying, listen, I've got to do something about this. I got to join the collective.
I think, Kirby, you know, both of us say in the newsletter over the last few weeks and probably continue to say it is, just go out and vote. You know, I'm actually not going to be in the country when there's voting. Heads up, I'm taking my sort of annual little trip overseas. I'm going to the Netherlands for a bit, and then I'm going through to the UK. But I have made arrangements to do early voting, in order to make sure that even though I'm not going to be here, I'm going to at least place my vote before we go there. One of the things that when we're looking at inflation is, yes, there are things that we have to get right on the South African side, but the price of oil is driving inflation right across the world. And until those Middle Eastern issues start to settle down, that oil price is not going to get back down to the sort of 70 level and then impact inflation. Because oil, of course, it impacts every single aspect of inflation because it's a logistics and that flows into the price of goods and it flows into the price of fertilizers. It is so insidious, this price of oil. We've become so dependent on it, not just to drive cars, that until that is moderated and comes down. And, I don't know about you, I don't see any sign of this happening. I know, is Ukraine going to be a lost cause? Are Ukraine going to have to give up and then be part of Russia? And what are the implications on that? There's still so much uncertainty out there.
Dawn, I think the other thing which I think is driving commodity prices, and oil is obviously part of that commodity complex, is in the US and Europe, there's a large monetary debasement happening. So the Americans know that they have a debt pile that they can't service. They know that. And they know that in order to continue to grow the economy, they're going to have to add to the debt pile. So monetary debasement really has got to do with the ability to be able to take the debt that you have and monetizing it with new debt issuance. Because remember, those bonds come up to their call dates, and then you as a government have an option. You either repay those bonds or you issue new bonds in order to try and repay those bonds, which is in essence what is happening at this stage. And that debasement process that's busy happening has got the world kind of running, and this I'm talking about the financial world now, running in a bit of a flurry because they're kind of saying, well, if there's all this monetary debasement happening, I can't really buy a kind of bonds, long-dated bonds, and try and match liabilities long term. But how do I keep the value of my currency going? And how do they do that? Well, they buy growth assets. So the money flows into markets. So people say, well, if I buy a company with real earnings that sell real products, then I'm able to at least keep pace with that. Bitcoin is a great example of that. Let me take my money out of dollars and euros and other asset classes and try and currency units and put it into Bitcoin because at least that keeps pace with it. And that's part of the interest in that. And then commodities is the other big one. And oil just forms part of those commodities. It's a hard asset. People buy the hard asset because they kind of say, well, I can keep my currency unit at least intact by buying hard commodities rather than trying just to leave it in the currency unit. And that's the play of the world that we're seeing at the moment busy going on. And obviously, the Federal Reserve and the ECB on a continuous basis are trying to plug holes as they're going through 2024, creating more liquidity here, taking a little bit away from there, and trying to just create an even keel out of all of this. And that's why we're seeing markets in this flurry and this com and commodities, quite frankly. Now, the South African commodity base. So if you look, I mean, right across the companies in South Africa, we haven't seen commodity companies in South Africa. So these are resource companies. Really, any benefit by owning those? We've seen the COVID highs, and that was really because those prices spiked and you saw company prices spiking as well. But we're starting to see commodity prices spiking, but companies haven't yet followed, so to speak, as, from a price perspective. So you continue to see those under pressure. Now, when those turn around, that could actually be quite good news for South Africa and quite good news for South African markets, which are just battling at the moment. I mean, as a matter of fact, you show two graphs again that you show every single week, which is the South African market against the Dow Jones. And you could just see how South Africa battles,
Toby, I think one of the sort of interesting things, and I've started to put that graph into the newsletter on a weekly basis, is the strength of the dollar. And in this week's newsletter, I've actually looked at the strength of the dollar from inception of the DXY index, which is back in the 1970s. And it's a very interesting graph. And look, I haven't been close enough to that sort of economics and that you have, for example. But it's really interesting to see in the 80s how the strength of the dollar just went through the roof, right? But and
Yes.
sort of then stays there down below the sort of 100 level, which is almost like the on par was where it started. But now it has been sustainably strong. Now, obviously, the strength of the dollar is a vanity project, apart from anything else, for Biden,
Yeah,
right? And
sure.
as it was for Trump, they don't boast about having a weak dollar. They boast about having a strong dollar. So, we're probably going to continue to see a strong dollar at least until the elections are over, and then maybe sanity can prevail. Because, I mean, by letting the dollar become weaker also sorts out some of their problems, but can also create inflationary problems.
And that's exactly the issue, is that they'd rather keep the dollar strong because it helps the American consumer at the end of the day. American consumer has a strong dollar and they're able to utilize their strong dollar to buy product from international markets, and they can go on holiday and they feel that they've got buying power at the end of the day. That obviously isn't good for inflation ultimately. And that's what we saw in the latest month, where we just saw a slight uptick in American inflation, US inflation, and that actually had markets a bit spooked lately. And you speak about that in the newsletter, where you speak about some of the Federal Reserve members actually talking about, listen, maybe we drop rates, but only later on this year. And then all of a sudden markets just slump because markets are really anticipating and looking forward to trying to see if they can actually get rates lower and quicker at the end of the day. The fear, though, is that if you do that and you drop rates that quickly, you might just feel the next spike in inflation, and they don't want that. They want to try and kind of stay kind of as conservative as they possibly can, but they always run the risk that they're just behind the curve all the time, which is really was the case when inflation started spiking. They were behind the curve, that was a big criticism.
The Federal Reserve obviously tries to keep out of the politics of the American electoral system, as it were, but it's almost impossible to do so. A drop of in interest rates, even if it's only a marginal 25 basis points, maybe a month before the elections, would be great for Biden, right?
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. Yeah.
But historically, they have not done that, right? Deliberately. Because so that it's not seen as favoring one side over the other. I think that having sort of missed the boat in terms of doing it in March, which is, what last year we were talking about them doing the first cuts in March and then in April and then in May, and it's now being pushed out much closer because the elections are on the 5th of November, the US elections, 5th of November, that unless they do them sooner, then they're starting to get into the real campaigning season, and any kind of movement would be seen as political. And then somebody like, I mean, if they drop the rates, and somebody like Trump will say, you're just buying votes or whatever. So, yeah.
But talking about Trump, you write a fascinating piece this week in the newsletter around the merger between Digital World Acquisition Corporation and Trump Media and Technology. This is obviously to create this new entity, which is really backed by Donald Trump, and it's the owner of Truth Social, which is really his social media platform, so to speak. It started as a more fair type platform, and where it speaks, well, in his opinion, truth at the end of the day. But Dawn, it's very interesting because what they've done is Digital World Acquisition Corporation was really set up as a special purpose acquisition company. So really speaking, it's an entity that gets created. And what is its job? Its job is to go and find things to buy so that you could create a company. These things often are very hypey, and they are prone to huge price volatility, as one saw with GameStop during, only a couple of years ago. And people really pump the share price, and then they dump it at the end of the day. It's a part of the market which doesn't really attract serious investor capital, institutional investor capital, but it's an interesting part of the market. Now, Dawn, it's interesting because I went to Trump Media and Technology. I went to the website, and really speaking, if you look at the website, they really appeal to the American nationalists, the guy or the woman that wants to see an America run by Donald Trump. And really speaking, what he's asking for is that they put money, so to speak, into the share so that they can assist him at the end of the day. That really is what it is at the end of the day. And you can see it by the share price. If you go across into the newsletter, you can actually go and look at a graph of the actual share price. You could see how it's been pumped and then invariably dumped. Now, it hasn't been dumped far enough for Trump not to potentially get a windfall out of it, but it's not really investable.
And Kobe, I think very interestingly, I mean, the three-letter acronym that is used on NASDAQ, as it's on the NASDAQ, is DJT, Donald, whatever his name is,
Donald J. Trump. Yes.
Donald
Yeah.
J. Trump, right? So, I mean,
Yes.
it's a vanity project from start to finish. Quite infuriating, and I didn't realize it, and it's really not come out in the media, is that if he can stay above the $17.80 that it was floated at, the IPO was floated at, for more than 30 days, then he gets a bonus of billions. I mean, it
Yeah.
just is
One and a half to two
maddening, but
billion.
you
Yeah.
know that it is what it is.
Yeah.
But
I'd like that bonus. I'd
yeah.
like to get a chance of that kind of bonus. I mean, but that's the joke of the whole thing, is that I think that Donald Trump, certainly in business, has been a lot of hot air, and he's used high finance in order to try and create a lot of this hot air. Perhaps maybe in his beginning phases, and I'm going back to the 1980s, one could potentially argue that he was pretty good at property development. But that's probably where all of this ended at the end of the day. He's more persona than he is about business. There's no real business substance around any of these things. And it's interesting because look, the share price is at $40 at the moment. That's where it listed Dawn, at $17. It was as high as $64 only a short while ago. It's now at $40. And I'm pretty certain some people will go and put money into this thing, you know, and kind of say, well, you know, I believe perhaps, you know, let's put money into something like this. It's an absolute vanity project at the end of that. But you know, Dawn, you look at something like GameStop. I remember clients when GameStop was had its major run up in share price. I remember clients running and saying, listen, buy me some, I'd like some GameStop. And I was like, what are you buying? I don't know. Just buy me some. That's like, you need to at least understand what you buy. I mean, if you don't know what you buy, then it's pointless, because then you're just asking to get lucky. And if you don't get lucky, what then? Then where does that end up for you? Getting lucky isn't a proven strategy for retirement. It's and to get you to retirement, you know? Certainly if you put in the hard yards and the hard work and everything else, you know, to try and get to a point, and then you get lucky, that's all absolutely perfect. There's no problem with that. It's not a strategy on its own at the end of the day.
I think Kobe, and I mean, you and I were discussing this a little bit offline, is that it brings us into the murky world of behavioral finance, of understanding that often the biggest problem with somebody's portfolio is not the asset allocation, it's themselves, it's their behavior. And you've written a very detailed section there on Daniel Kahneman, who is, you know, he's the guy that did that original experiment with marshmallows with children, where you give a child two marshmallows and you say to them, you know, it's delayed gratification, in other words. I mean, and he was the father of that, but it's all behavioral finance. And you know, we put in there a couple of, you know, what behavioral finance is, and we talk a little bit about the Dunning-Kruger effect. But I mean, even if you just read that, you probably end up, say, understanding even less and understanding that this is such a murky area, and that our personal experiences and the way we've been brought up and, you know, things that have happened to us impact our financial decisions to a far greater extent than we, you know, we think.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the world before Daniel Kahneman, and I make the point that when Daniel Kahneman won his Nobel Prize, which was in 2002, I was 28 years old. And suddenly, the world before, the finance world before Daniel Kahneman was one of numbers, rationality, and the understanding of how all of this stuff fits together. So if you were in a bank, you would sit and you would understand the world in front of you, but you would always express it in numbers. And the world had lurched from one financial crisis to the next. There had been various iterations of these things, and people couldn't explain it. And people said, well, we just have to become smarter at this. And smarter meant more, hiring more accountants, hiring more actuaries, you know, making sure that you've got, you know, at some point they started hiring people in maths, which is not a bad thing, you know, having somebody that's very good at maths and understanding the mathematics behind finance is really important. But the same mistakes happen over and over and over again. And it was Daniel Kahneman that basically revolutionized that area by coming in and saying, well, it's not the formula, it's not the market, it's not the economical system. The problem is you. That's the problem. Because the problem is your own psychological psyche and your mindset that you bring to your world of work at the end of the day. And if you combine that with everybody else's psyches that you're working with, then you have this environment where things can go quite badly wrong. This is the thing that Daniel Kahneman brought to the market. Now, I remember when he brought this to the market and he started writing papers. I think a lot of people looked at this and they were in finance because now they came from the numbers area, so to speak, of finance. And they didn't want to believe this. They kind of said, this is rubbish, absolute rubbish. Why don't show me this stuff? Unless you can express it in a number, I don't want to see it. And yet Daniel Kahneman made a lot of sense. I'll give you one as an example. And as a matter of fact, if you're interested, he's just his latest the latest book he wrote before he passed away is Thinking Fast and Slow. You can go and buy it off Amazon. You can go buy it, put it on your Kindle. I mean, it's all fascinating. Here's a great one. He came up with a thing called sunk cost fallacy. So I don't know if you can remember a while ago. So firstly, what is sunk cost fallacy? It appears when you have an idea and you've spent a vast amount of resources. That could be time, it could be money, it could be both, it could be everything. And suddenly you kind of look at the thing, and because you've spent so much time trying to make this idea work in your mind, finally you make the numbers work. Or you spend so much time and money in a certain idea that you can't walk away from it anymore. And there's great examples of that. I think of Woolworths buying David Jones in Australia. And just spending vast amounts of money on David Jones. And ultimately, they finally got to a point and then literally had to start sinking some costs and start saying, listen, we're not going to see our money back on this thing. But if that happened before, and they actually just sat and said, is the disease here the sunk cost fallacy? Perhaps they wouldn't have been in that situation. There's just one very simple example. If you've heard of heuristics, there's another one that he's come up with. So I think he really went and revolutionized the way that people think about finance. And I think that is the legacy that Daniel Kahneman leaves to the world of finance. And he got a Nobel Prize for it.
And Kobe, I think also one of the most valuable things, because I've been an avid follower of Daniel Kahneman for since his book first came out, and I wasn't 28, right? But is that people ascribe emotions to their investments, and they will treat them differently in respect. And I've actually seen it with one or two of my clients that they will, for example, have bought themselves some shares. And the feeling is that why aren't you performing for me? I bought you, I've nurtured you, you're going to stay in my portfolio until you jolly well give me a return. It's just it's ascribing an emotion to it. I mean, I saw it even with my own father, who inherited war bonds. He would not touch those war bonds, even when we went through some, tough financial times, because they were left to him by his great uncle Jerry, who I never met.
There we go.
Right?
There you go. There
You
you
know,
go.
it's ascribing emotion. It's a complicated, muddy area, but the sooner you understand, what emotions you're bringing to your financial decision making, the better.
But Dawn, this is what good advisory work should do, And I mean, look, good advisory work kind of says, okay, fine, let's understand the assets and let's understand who you are and why you've treated your assets in a certain way. Why is it that you've got this asset pool, you've got asset pools in 30 different places? Why is that? Is it because you've had experience where perhaps you've had all your eggs in one basket and perhaps something has happened? Is it perhaps something that you've read? Is it perhaps something that you've experienced with your family? Why is it that you behave in this way? And what is the correct treatment of those assets? And what is the journey that you need to take in order to correct that at the end of the day? And that's a big part of what we do is trying to understand assets, the treatment of those assets, why it is in its current format, in its current structures, and what to do in order to actually change that. And look, Dawn, from an investment management perspective, That is part of the reason why there's a very robust process when we identify assets, because we know that all of these emotional issues lurk in the background all the time. You know, when we look at a company, people bring their personal feelings, you know, oh, I bought their products. Oh, I've used their service and they are brilliant, you know. The fact that the company has brilliant products doesn't make it a great investment, ultimately. You know, making a great investment has got a whole bunch of other factors involved with it, you know. But when you've got checklists and you've got specific processes that you run in order to understand an asset and understand what it is, then you suddenly get rid of some of these things so that you make less mistakes from an asset management perspective. I think they've done a study globally. The best managers in the world, Dawn, are only right about 50% of the time. 51, call it 51, 52% of the time. Those are the best guys in the world. Now, if you only write 50% or 51% of the time, how come you create outperformance? Well, you create outperformance because you've weighted those ideas correctly. But if the best in the world are only right 50, 51% of the time, you've got to make very certain that when you buy assets and you get the weightings right, that you haven't ascribed some emotional benefit or emotional baggage to those ideas. You followed a due process at the end of the day. And that's critical. Well, that's all for the week, folks. This podcast is based on our weekly free newsletter, which you can subscribe to at rexalom.co.za.
All our blogs and newsletters are also available on rexalom.co.za or wealthecology.co.za, and we welcome any suggestions for future topics. Thank you for lending us your ears.